Tech Day Part 2, Monday, March 12, 2018, from 1:30 to 3 p.m., room 209 BC.
Okay, good afternoon. If you can all settle down, then I don't have to call you by name for the record. Maybe I should call Robert Martin Lejeune by the name for the record for not sitting down. Okay, thank you very much for coming back after lunch. This morning we had well over 100 in attendance, which is quite cool. Usually we have more than the CCNS or has on their members meeting anyway. First in the afternoon is Pablo Rodriguez from .pr, and he will talk a little bit about their situation, their setup, and whether and how it was affected by the recent climatic events.
Thank you all, and good afternoon. We are honored to have you all in Puerto Rico. We greatly appreciate your support, so therefore, welcome. Welcome to Puerto Rico. We're very, very glad to have you all here. This morning, I would like to quickly go through some of the accomplishments that we have had throughout the years. And one that we are especially proud of is the fact that that PR was the second CCTLD right after Sweden in adopting the NSSEC. And that is a fact that not too many people know. And we would like to stress it and make it a point that indeed we did, and we presented this in 2006 in Sao Paulo. We have actually some of the people that helped us to make that implementation at the time. And pull some of that implementation helped us by promoting the NSSEC, the adoption of the NSSEC. It helped us by also inviting and inspiring other people to adopt other technologies in addition to that. I am going to skip some of that information to go on to what really brings us here. And our experience has helped us learn some very important lessons. And the idea is that our region is extremely vulnerable to natural disasters. Our region doesn't get one natural disaster. Sometimes we get two and three, rather close to each other. Let's take a quick look at that. Oops. Can we run that? Thank you.
President Trump declared an emergency today in Puerto Rico.
Residents were warned to brace for the worst.
Culebra fue una de las islas municipios que recibió los fuertes vientos del huracán Irma.
Maria, expected to become a hurricane later on, its path is actually following the path of Irma.
Puerto Rico está enfrentando por primera vez en unos 85 años un huracán categoría 5.
Que aquí hay que evacuar, hay que hacer desalojo, dejándole saber a todos los ciudadanos que esto es un peligro.
No lights. It is dark, entirely dark. And apparently it could take months to get the power back on. Just think about that for a second in the modern world. Months with no power.
Months with no power. But it's not only no power. When you don't have power, your water pumps don't work. So you get no water either. You don't have any telecommunications. You don't have any, besides not having any telecommunications, you don't have your elevators. The most mundane task, taking the garbage out. I live on an 18-story, on a 21-story building. Taking the garbage out is a major task. It's walking down 18 stories, walking up 18 stories, go and do groceries, bring a couple of bags, that's 18 stories up, 18 stories down. There is no gasoline. There is no radio. I remember turning on the radio and listening to a baseball game. And I said, who the hell is playing baseball right after a hurricane? Guess what? Our spectrum was so empty, we were capturing a baseball game from Venezuela. There was nothing, silence. And then again, that's when you begin to think about this. Are you ready for this? Are you prepared for this? I must tell you in advance that Puerto Rico, the NICTAD PR, we were operational prior, during, and after the hurricane, and we were 100% operational. But the idea is that less than 24 hours before the hurricane, Mexico had an earthquake. Hundreds of people died in Mexico City. A significant number of buildings collapsed. Right after that, a major Category 5 hurricane passed by Puerto Rico. Guess what? Prior to the Hurricane Maria, we had Hurricane Irma on a Wednesday. And that's a Cat 5 that destroyed a big portion of our infrastructure. And we were already limping. 8 days later, Hurricane Maria passed by, and it dumped so much water on us on already saturated grounds that those mountains melted, simply melted away, taking much of the telecommunications with them. Let me show you something. Kim, is there any way you can help me? Show me the that's the one. Thank you. Now, let us take a look at that picture. The upper picture is what Puerto Rico looked like prior to Maria. And it was taken from the International Space Station. The second picture was taken about 7 or 8 days ago by astronaut Joseph Acaba, who happens to be of Puerto Rican descent, and they just landed in Kazakhstan not too long ago. And when he took pictures of Puerto Rico from the International Space Station, that's what it looked like. As you can see, the most lit area of in that map, that's where we are. That's the metropolitan area. That's San Juan area. Look at the rest of the island. It's barely lit. Therefore, you can imagine how little restoration of the service is available. The electrical service is limping terribly. In addition to that, the telecommunication service is also limping. So to talk about internet, to talk about anything else, it's redundant because we need to get this going first before we can start moving on to bigger and better services. Let me show you. That's what some of our telecommunication towers look like. We had nearly 1,630-40 towers, of which, after the atmospheric phenomenon, we end up with about 200-300 of them. The rest were completely destroyed, demolished, literally ripped from their cement bases. Look at this. These are 40-foot poles in concrete. Their core is steel. And that core, when you look at it, was completely twisted. These are telecommunication towers whose wires weigh tons. And to raise them, you need helicopters. We had Chinook helicopters helping us to raise this type of towers. And it was barely impossible. Over and over and over again, we experienced that type of catastrophe. And the idea is, we talked about disaster recovery planning. But most people tend to think about one disaster. How about two? How about three? How about getting hit by an earthquake, a tsunami, and a hurricane? Is that possible? But it appears so. It appears that that can be the case. So we use the domain name status.pr, and we use that as a tool to provide complete transparency and information to the people in Puerto Rico and throughout the world. It was published throughout CNN, and it was the official website for everyone to come and get information on what was happening in Puerto Rico. It's still available and still operational. At this point, or at the moment that I took this, that I made this presentation, our telecommunication service is back on about 98.5%, and we continue to make improvements. But as you saw earlier in a previous slide, the restoration of electrical service is still very slow, and we still need to do a lot more and a lot better. This is one of the problems that we have. Back in the 70s, Puerto Rico bet on becoming an oil refinery hub. And so we developed a lot of the electrical production of electricity. It was placed in the southern portion of the island. However, the northern portion of the island has the highest use and consumption of electricity. So after the hurricane, we end up with production in the south, consumption in the north, and nothing in between. Trying to get the wires across our topography, although we're a very small island, only 100 miles long by 35 miles wide, it was a major task, and it continues to be a major challenge. So that is part of that slow process in making that restoration of that electricity. Now, what did we do? Well, this isn't the first time. We're not alien to disasters. And many of you will remember the disaster that occurred in Japan in 2011, where they experienced a 9.1 earthquake And right after that, they had a tsunami. Mighty Japan was uncommunicated. Their grid was destroyed in a significant percentage of it. And many, many people were unable to communicate. At that time, we knew that we should do something to help out, to help protect the cyber real estate of domain name users in Japan. We knew that we had customers, registrars in Japan, so immediately we set out to search our databases and see how many domain names we had where the country of origin was Japan or in the vicinity of those who were affected by the earthquake and subsequent tsunami. Well, fast forward that, and 7 years later, those lessons learned from the Japanese event where we set out to identify those domain names and then immediately we extended their expiration date to avoid those end users from losing their domain names. We used those lessons, we applied those lessons learned on us. And we began searching our databases for domain names that had been registered either in Puerto Rico, whose country of origin was Puerto Rico, or the Virgin Islands, or Dominica, or Antigua and Barbuda, because these were all the areas that were affected by either Irma or Hurricane Maria. We identified 626 domain names, and immediately we extended the expiration date. Till this date, some of those users who have not responded, we are still waiting for them, and we are not letting those domain names we are not deleting those domain names. So what's the point here? The point is that when a natural disaster occurs, for those of us who are registries and or registrars, we have a responsibility into looking our databases, searching our databases, and trying to see if any of those domain names that exist in our databases are coming from those countries and or territories that were exposed to that natural disaster or were affected in any way. And then we must do something to protect them. So what did we learn and what do we continue to share with our people? The Latin American and Caribbean region is prone to natural disasters, and we have seen it, as I mentioned earlier. Mexico experienced an earthquake less than 24 hours before Puerto Rico was ransacked by a hurricane. Irma had affected terribly the Caribbean region, the southern portion of the Caribbean region, and we continue to help out those people, and a week later we got hit by our own hurricane. So am I responsible for my brother? We believe so. We believe we are. I believe we are. And so we did. We took all the measures that we could to protect the people that could have possibly been affected by these hurricanes. And I continue to push so that every single one of us can develop policy or help out to develop policy that can protect the cyber real estate of those users in each of the registries and registrars throughout the world. This is not something that occurs only in the Latin American and Caribbean region or in the Pacific Rim, but we have seen very recently the floods in Paris. We have seen the climate change in so many different areas throughout the world. Chances are that at some point, our regions, each one of our regions, will be affected by some type of natural disaster. So will we be prepared for that? Will we be prepared to manage more than one catastrophe, more than one disaster? That's what we need to do Disaster recovery planning is extremely important. And in addition to that, to have the sensibility to know that even if a disaster occurs on the other side of the planet from your perspective, chances are that you may have customers there. What are you going to do to protect them? Do you feel that you are responsible or not? Well, I feel that we are, and therefore we acted on it. That said, I'd like to thank you all for taking the time to listen to me, and I hope that some of these experiences can be of help to you and give you some food for thought, and that some of that can be put into action and inspire you if you have not already began thinking about this disaster recovery planning to engage into that activity, because it will make the difference between having a registry or registrar, having a company, or not having one. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Excellent presentation. I'll allow one question just now, but I want to say from the rostrum again, abusing the prerogative of the chair, we shouldn't just look at disaster recovery or disaster mitigation. We should look at it from an aspect of business continuity. You lost Professor Moreno a few years ago. So that my colleague just died over the weekend. Fortunately, we are elderly people, so we had some idea that could happen, and we had already put structures in place. But this is probably something that especially younger people in smaller companies don't really look at. For example, they have got 8 staff members. It's probably not a very good idea to let all 3 technical people go on the same plane when there is a bad weather or something. Little things like this. And for that reason, I'm very keen on having in Barcelona a session on from the technical, but also from the organizational side on business continuity. Patricio is next. He had a similar situation during the earthquake, and I remember very fondly the remote presentation he gave in Nairobi when he was not even there, and he could do it via the Adobe Connect.
Thanks. Patricio Poblete from NIC Chile, and it's true, we're not strangers to disasters ourselves. I find remarkable what you said, that you were able to maintain operational continuity throughout all this disaster. But in addition to hearing about what you did, I'd like to know more about how you did it. For instance, with no power, no telecommunications, and so on, were you able to operate from here, or did you have sufficient resources abroad that you could use? Operational continuity, of course, I understand that refers to domain name resolution, but were you also able to take new registrations, do the invoicing, and so on?
Thank you, Patricio. It was a pleasure. We had 2 co-locations. We had one called Critical Hub, and we have a bunker at AT&T. Both of them had generators, and our systems were running from both locations that were redundant, and they were mirrors to each other. By the fifth day, one of them, the critical hub one, went down for lack of diesel fuel. Imagine we had no diesel, no gasoline, no nothing running. Available. The AT&T hub had diesel for 5 days, and we continued to run from that, and then we were praying, hoping that somehow we could get our hands on diesel. But our governor made sure that once he got his hands on diesel fuel, he made it a point that hospitals and telecommunication companies were a priority. And that's how AT&T got their diesel, and we were able to continue. And it was completely transparent to everyone throughout the island and throughout the world. So we continue to support domain name registrations, answer email, renew domain names. It was completely transparent to our users. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Impressive presentation, and keep it up.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Warren Kumari from Google, or in his IETF hat, or whatever hat, he is wearing today, if any, is going to speak about KSK Sentinel.
Let me just check if the forward and back works. Yes. So when I started making this presentation, I thought it was about a fairly large problem. But after just seeing, you know, this last presentation, it kind of resets your expectations of what's a major issue and what's not. But anyway, this is going to be a quick presentation on the KSK Sentinel. It's myself and Joao and Jeff. There's Jeff. So what's the problem we're trying to solve here? So I'm assuming that most people here are fairly familiar with DNSSEC, or at least somewhat familiar with DNSSEC. For those who are not, some of this will be clear, some of it won't. But what's the problem we're trying to solve? Well, we'd really like to roll the DNSSEC trust anchor. That's the root KSK. And users who are using a validating resolver that do not yet know about the new KSK will simply break. All of their DNS resolutions will just stop working. They won't be able to resolve any names. They won't be able to reach the internet. They will basically be dead in the water. And more worryingly, we don't have any real way of measuring who currently has the new KSK, who doesn't have the new KSK, who's just relying on resolvers with new ones or old ones. This just isn't something we can measure, and so we don't really know how many people will be affected when the KSK roll happens. So for people who've been coming to these for a while, they might remember there was this thing called RFC 8145. It is supposed to provide reporting on this. I was one of the authors of it. It seemed like it would be great. It does actually provide some reporting, but what it reports on is actually what the resolvers will see. So this provides reporting from the resolvers to the root servers, which particular key they have. This seems like what we wanted to measure, but once it was deployed, we realized there were more things that we wanted to know. For example, I personally have a validating resolver in my basement. For various long and convoluted reasons, it does not have the new KSK. However, it doesn't really matter because nobody's using it. Right? There's a resolver sitting in a basement, nobody queries it. Does it really matter if it doesn't have the new KSK? Nope, because when it breaks, it's not going to affect anyone. The RFC 8145 stuff does, however, make pretty graphs. Created this graph which shows that not all of the resolvers have actually been upgraded and not all of the resolvers have the new key. When this graph was made, there were around 5% of resolvers which did not have the new key. For some reason, that number has increased to around 30% of resolvers, or sorry, validating resolvers that do not have the new key. So things have gotten worse. But fundamentally, this makes pretty graphs. It doesn't actually tell us the most important thing, which is how many users will be affected. It tells us some set of resolvers will die, but it doesn't provide any information on how many users or which particular ones will be affected. And so we don't really know what the impact of the key roll will be. So we have this new thing which we think will actually answer these. It requires a small resolver update. And more importantly, it allows anybody who can publish something in the DNS to be able to actually set up some measurement service and understand how the key roll is going. More importantly than that, it allows users to actually test this themselves. So this will allow users to have a look and understand what the results of the key roll will be for them. The way it does this is it's a simple change to the DNS protocol or DNSSEC protocol. The very last thing that a resolver that implements this will do just before sending the response back, is it has a look, and it sees if the leftmost label in the name contains KSK role dash sentinel dash HTA dash some key. If it does have that, and if the resolver has that particular key ID, it sends back the answer normally. If it does not have that key ID, it converts the answer into a serve fail response. And serve fail is sort of the generic DNS response for something went wrong when I was doing things and, you know, I had an error. The other rule is if the leftmost label starts with KSK rule sentinel not TA and then a key ID, then if the resolver does not have this particular key, then it replies normally. Otherwise, it answers with a serve fail. So these are the only two changes that need to happen, and a number of resolvers have started actually deploying this. And the reason we have both the is TA and not TA is that we can determine which particular resolvers actually support this mechanism. And there's an example of that in a second. These slides work better when they're presented from the web and each line comes up one at a time, but I'll go through the scenario. So I'm a validating resolver. I also support Sentinel, and I have the new KSK. The new key ID is 20326. So I'm sitting there and I'm running along happily, and I get a query for invalid.example.com. This name happens to be DNSSEC bogus. It's signed with an incorrect key. So I do what I would normally do. I reply with a serve fail. A little bit later, I get a query for KSK role sentinel is ta2326.example.com. I do all of my normal DNSSEC work, all of my normal DNS validation. I go if I resolve it. It happens in this case to resolve to 192.0.2.23. You know, that's just an example address. It resolves to some address. Just before I send back the response, I see that this particular query started with a magic string KSK role dash sentinel is TA. And so I check and I see, oh, the key ID that it's asking about, 20326, is a key ID that I have. And so I do my normal response. I just answer, yep, here's your answer, it's 192.0.2.20. A few seconds later, I get a query for KSK role sentinel not TA 20326.example.com. I have the key ID, 20326, so I use the second rule in the sort of set of changes. And I convert the answer into a serve fail, and I send that back. So it's because I don't not have 20326 that I send that back. For Simpsons fans, that's sort of like, I'm not licking toads. So now we've added a bunch of complexity to DNS. Why is this helpful? So the plan is, once this is implemented, we ask users to go off to a web page. And on the web page, we have three different images. One of them is invalid.example.com/fish. One of them is KSK role sentinel is ta20326.example.com/kitten. And one of them is not ta20326.example.com/puppy. And we ask users, do you see a picture of a fish? If you see a picture of a fish, then that means that you are able to somehow resolve the invalid.example.com/fish name. The only way that you could have resolved that name is if you're not doing DNSSEC validation. Right? It's an invalidly signed name. If you were somehow able to resolve that, that means you're not doing DNSSEC validation. That also means that the key role doesn't affect you in any way. You don't need to worry about this. You can just ignore the problem. There is no issue for you. If you see a picture of a kitten and a puppy, then that means that it is simultaneously true that you do have and you don't have that trust anchor. The only way that that could be true is if you don't yet understand this mechanism. You know, you're able to resolve both of these names. You can't both have that key and not have that key. So that just means you don't yet know how to do this. Unfortunately, that means that we can't actually tell you if you'll survive the key role or not. If you're able to see a kitten and only a picture of a kitten, then that means you've got the new key. It means that you have 20326 and you don't not have 20326. And so that's how you're able to resolve the kitten and not the puppy. And so you will be just fine. If the only thing that you see is a picture of a puppy, then that means that you do not have 20326. You were not able to resolve the kitten. You were able to resolve the picture of the puppy. And so that means that you are in danger when the KSK roll finishes, you will not have the new key, and all of your DNS will break. So, are we seriously going to do this with pictures of kittens and puppies and asking people to please have a look and tell us what happens? I wish that we would. That would be really awesome. Sadly, no. We will instead send people a big blob of JavaScript. And what this JavaScript does, I'm not sure if you can read it on the screen, but basically it does that test before, on the previous screen. It makes you load, or it makes your browser load three different resources. One of them is invalidly signed. One of them is TA20326. The other one is not TA20326, and I've just realized I have a typo on my slide. And then there's some JavaScript, and it has a look to see which one of the resources it was able to reach and which ones it was able to actually render. And from that, it will tell you if you can or cannot survive the key roll. If you actually try that from this particular network, you're behind DNSSEC validating resolvers. They do not yet support this update, and Eberhard is busy doing it as we speak. And what you will get is a page that looks like this. It will tell you, you're using a legacy resolver. We cannot tell you whether or not you will survive the key roll. But, once these resolvers are upgraded, you will hopefully see, yep, you will be just fine. I think that this is my last slide, other than, I had a discussion with pictures of kittens and puppies and stuff, and so you didn't get a picture of a kittens and puppies. Here's the gratuitous kittens. I don't know why they're gardening, but they are. And so here's your kittens and questions. I think many people might have seen this at the DNSSEC presentation, so we might not have as many questions as expected. Let's see.
Any questions? Don Hollander has one.
Don Hollander from Brookhaven in New Zealand. In the past, Jeff has run these very clever advertising-based sensors to see. Have you done that with this?
This is Jeff Houston from APNIC. I was a co-author of this draft with Warren. It's been a real problem with this role of the KSK. The way the DNS currently works and the way resolvers currently work, it is impossible to test the preparedness of the new KSK prior to it coming in unless we change something. Something has to change. We either have to change the DNSSEC protocol itself, which in turn means altering the behaviour of every single validating resolver, probably by bringing up a golden name in the root zone, it's only signed with the new key and da-da-da-da-da-da. Gets horrendously complicated very, very quickly. Or, this is slightly simpler, it doesn't change the protocol, but it must change the action of validating resolvers, that they take what would normally be a validated secure response and under certain circumstances, depending on the query name, alters it from, yeah, that's okay, to serve fail. So it's basically a downgrade from, I'm not going to tell you the answer under certain circumstances. We can do this with a mass ad and mass testing. That's fine. You can do it yourself, as Warren showed with his page. So it's not exclusively a test that only I or someone else with golden keys can handle. Literally anyone can set this up and test wherever they want to test. So that's kind of the good news. The bad news is resolvers have to change. So there's certainly a conversation with the folk who build resolver code to say, you need to put this in your code. If you find this particular Sentinel label, change your behaviour. Folk who run resolvers, ISPs, etc., should be keeping up with releases. If you're running a big resolver and the version is, 5 years old, you're in, deep kinds of stuff. No matter which way you look at it, you should be keeping up to date. But it does take time for this to come out. Will we have answers if everything goes according to track by October of this year, which is the current plan day? Really don't know. It's up to a whole bunch of variables that I have no control over. But literally, in thinking around this problem, there's no other way to do a reliable way of mass measurement we can see that doesn't entail pain of this order of magnitude. There's just nothing we can do any other way. Thanks.
But actually, following up from that, the knot resolver has already started implementing this, and some other resolvers are planning on implementing it, or we're talking to them about implementing it. So once they have implemented it, there will be some delay till they get deployed, and then, yep, Jeff's planning on doing some
implementing. And it would be great if someone like ICANN could encourage these resolver vendors to actually do this quickly, and then we'll just go and kneecap folk who run resolvers to actually implement the latest version of the code.
Any other questions? Anything from the remote? There is Robert Martin Lejeune.
This is Robert Martin Lejeune from PCH. This is an RFC draft for experimental. What's the plan? Because the problem we're having now with the road, we are probably gonna keep seeing for every 5 years.
So, yep, it's currently a DNSSOP adopted IETF draft. We're hoping that it's going to go to working group last call real soon now, like possibly in London. And then shortly after that, it'll be published as an RFC. However, we think it is largely stable enough now that people can already start implementing it. We're not really expecting large changes. So resolver operators should be able to start implementing, and many have, based upon the current spec. So, yep, it would be nice if it went a little faster. This is probably, it's on track to be one of the fastest DNSSOP published RFCs in a long time, not that that's saying a huge amount. But yeah, that's the status currently. I can't remember if we put informational or standards track. Can you remember what we...
No, I can't remember the standards track.
Yeah, we probably put proposed standard on, but I'll have a look while Victor asks.
Right. My name is Victor Duchovny. I also run a survey, and I'm well aware that my survey is heavily biased to measure just the things I know how to measure. It can't measure the things I don't know how to measure, so it doesn't report on them. This one, too, seems to me will only measure the resolvers that get upgraded to implement it, and those might very well be the ones that might as well damn well deploy the new key. Why wouldn't they? In fact, they should deploy the new key and maybe skip this step, or, well, perhaps not for the future. So the question is, how will you get visibility to the folk who really need the help, who are still stuck in the 2010 key?
So what this does that's sort of different is it breaks the world up into four sets of people. Those who don't validate, which we can detect. Those who will be fine because they have the new key. Those who will die because they do not have the new key. And then those who are just legacy and aren't upgraded. So we can classify people into one of those four buckets. And the people who are legacy and we can't tell anymore, that's kind of our error margin. And so it provides data. Yes, it would be great if anybody who upgrades and installs the new software that supports this also installed the new key. However, sadly, for many implementations, upgrading keeps the same config file. And with bind at least, there's a stanza in there. You can either have managed keys, which says, you know, do all of the key roll magic automatically, or it has trusted keys. If it says trusted keys, it says use this key and only this key. So yeah, potentially a reasonable thing for resolver implementers to do would be to just ignore trusted keys and pretend that it said managed keys or something. But what this will do is it'll let us actually know sort of the error bars, and it will deal with the fact that some resolver software doesn't yet understand that 5011 is probably automatically rolling the key is a good thing. The other issue with that is I think what we might have seen why we've now gone to 30% people who only have the old key. The process for rolling the key says when the old key introduces a new key, you have to wait 30 days before you start trusting it. And many people have machines that are, you know, virtual machines or run Docker or something similar, and they learn the new key, but they're never alive for the full 30 days, and so they never actually finish the key role. So yeah, it would be great if upgrading things fixed it, but sadly not. And Jeff has a comment, I'm guessing.
Yeah, this is an additional comment. Two things. Firstly, Victor, we told ourselves exactly the same thing over a year ago, that folk doing DNSSEC validation had turned it on deliberately, that obviously they were going to follow a key role. This whole thing about sort of looking for folk who were failing was kind of irrelevant because there really wasn't going to be an awful lot of folk there. Part of the reason why it got postponed was that signal was completely unexpected. We couldn't understand what was going on. So there is some problem going on there with RFC 5011 and following a key role. However, understand another thing too, which is subtle but important. 8145 is about resolvers. This Sentinel is about you as a user and your cloud of DNS resolution. The Sentinel will not identify recalcitrant resolvers. It doesn't try and peek into the cloud of the way DNS is resolved. It simply says, as a user, with those list of resolvers that you have in etcresolve.conf, A, are you going to get affected by a key role? Are all of your resolvers validating? Because if one of them doesn't, you're okay. Because when you get stranded, the serve file will send you to the one that doesn't validate. If all of your resolvers validate, the test goes on to say, if all of them are not following the key, you're in deep, deep doo-doo. Now, not all the resolvers are going to update. This is a matter of statistics. But now we've got a beautiful set of numbers. The number of users who don't use DNSSEC validation at all, bucket A. The number of folk who use resolvers that see this Sentinel and are following, bucket B. The number of users who use this Sentinel that aren't following, bucket C. And we've got bucket D, the number of folks still using resolvers that don't support it. We can work out the population of all those three at any time and put the unassigned bucket back into the B's and C's. We can estimate the damage for users. Unfortunately, we can't help you fix your resolver. We don't know what your resolver does. That's your problem. From the office of the CTO and ICANN, it's all about user damage, not fixing your car.
All right, thank you very much. When I tested it, I got legacy, and my resolvers are 8888 and 88444.
Yeah. So,
do you know anybody at Google?
Maybe. So yes, I think they currently report that. Part of the thing is, Google doesn't do RFC 5011 for key role. Decided for us, it's safer to do a manual key role, you know, with people standing by and watching it. But there's a reasonable chance that we'll start reporting on this, you know, answering these questions. So that users can understand that in a more transparent way.
I am soon. Quite confident that if and when it happens, I don't have to change resolvers. Okay, Nick Coley, where are you? There you are, hi. Nick Coley is from Google, working on the Loon project, and he's going to talk to us about it. And you have got... half an hour.
Sure.
No, sorry, 50 minutes.
Sure. There we go. Okay, we'll switch gears a little bit from kittens mining cryptographic keys to something a little different. Thank you for welcoming me here, Dr. Lucy, and I'm sure I speak on behalf of all Tech Day to give my condolences for your business partner. It's very unfortunate. This is my first ICANN, so I'm quite riveted, but this is probably my 100th time to Puerto Rico, so I'm a little full of enchantment in that regard, at least. So I have that going for me. Let's see, is this... Okay. So I'm, as Dr. Lisa mentioned, from Project Loon, and I lead the operations group globally there, and I want to tell you a bit about our project and its relevance here in Puerto Rico, as we've heard throughout the day a little bit of. So the problem that we're trying to address as a project and as part of a greater impact is something that you heard in a keynote this morning, but also throughout our efforts is that there's 4 billion people that are offline.
telecommunications has a lot to do with that. Our work in networking across the world has a lot to do with that. All of you have a great deal to do with that. But less than half of the people, if this was a global population, the person next to you would not be online, and that is a huge, huge issue. So gaining access for global citizens is something that we're very passionate about. There's many ways to attack this problem, and they're going to all work jointly. We don't see ourselves as a one-stop solution, and we'll get in more into that and the strengths of different projects, such as we've partnered with AT&T to do in Puerto Rico. So that's a great deal of this talk. But first, I wanted to kind of give a general overview of Loon for those of you that may be not familiar. Our operations are flying high-altitude balloons with the extension equipment to be able to deploy LTE service, a cellular network. And so you can think of Loon as a network as a service platform that we can work with communications providers to extend service in places and parts of the world that they have nothing today. So we use a helium-filled high-altitude balloon that goes well above aircraft and weather to heights of 60,000 feet. The balloons are not stationary. They're actually mobile. And one of the unique qualities of our system is that we actually extrapolate the winds to be able to take us where we want to go. So we have the ability to to harness the winds and through a lot of computing power, figure out where the winds are going to take us. And we do a lot of sailing with the internet in tow to our users on the ground. So just in general, there's three real key components to this. One is the ability to navigate, something we spent many years on in the early parts of this project before we were ready to talk about this with the world, was could we really actually make a balloon go where it needed to go when it needed to be there? So there's a very large, complex team of software engineers. I know a few places that are good at that. And they work on this very problem, which is taking the weather forecasting and modeling today of the winds aloft in the environment and things like storms and things like global phenomenon and what they do to that, to be able to ride these balloons above the jet stream in the stratosphere at 60,000 feet and have them actually work their way up and down. So the balloons carry a balloon film, and then inside that is another actual little balloon. We call it the ballonet. That balloon has a compressor attached to it. We can take on atmospheric air, thus becoming heavier, and ballast ourselves down a few hundred feet, and then release that ballast and go and ballast ourselves, release that and go back up a few hundred feet. So essentially our balloons have the ability to ride the elevator shaft of winds in degrees of hundreds or thousands of feet in an altitude range, often from the top ends of the jet stream at 55,000 feet all the way to 70,000 feet, depending on what's optimal for us. And so we're able to use that along with the data that we get collecting wind speed and direction, along with the forecasts that are already publicly available for our aircraft and through the weather services, to find out what winds and what streams are going to be able to take us from our launch sites, whether they're here in Puerto Rico, which we do have one on the island, or a test facility in Nevada, and navigate a balloon precisely within hundreds of meters to exactly where it needs to be in space and time. And those two are very different and very complex in their own right, but we have to make them work together. So an example of that in 2014 was we took a balloon from our Puerto Rico launch site and navigated across the world, it was from New Zealand. We had a launch site in New Zealand, and we went around the world, and we were able to navigate it right over one of our test sites in Chile within 500 meters after it had done a couple laps. So we're constantly harnessing the power of our algorithms that search out these winds and how they extrapolate that information, and so we're growing using a lot of machine learning and a lot of anomaly detection to figure out not only the balloons sharing the wind data they experience, but as we introduce new forecasts every 6 hours into the aerospace community, that forecast improves our model as well. The second part is this clustering concept. So if you think of us deploying a network as a service extension of your pick your favorite cellular carrier, what we're doing is we're bringing one balloon over atop users to be able to provide that coverage. And as soon as the winds are going to drift that balloon away, another is right behind it to take its place. That was the model for a long time for us. And so through research, we said, well, this is simple. We just take a fleet of balloons, very inexpensive, a tenth or a hundredth of the cost of a satellite, and we adopt a ring of balloons around the world at a latitude band we need to coverage. Through all of the learning we've done, we've actually moved away from that and grown into this newer concept, which is sort of completely turned the tide for us, which is we've been able to extrapolate the winds enough and go up and down enough in frequency that we can actually have the balloons sort of create their own microscopic area that they travel in circles in, if you'd say. So a balloon can find enough altitude range to cluster in the same spot, and similar to station keeping, if you'd think of it. So the balloon actually, untethered in the stratosphere, is able to go up and down enough to stay in the same relative coverage area of 40 to 60 kilometers and continue to maintain a consistent cone of coverage down on the ground. It's really been pretty groundbreaking for us in the field of high altitude ballooning and then also in the field of stratospheric or space communications. And the thing that I would leave you with that sets us very much apart from anybody that's doing anything of this type today is that what we've been able to build from the very first prototypes that were beer coolers of styrofoam bought from our local 7-Eleven or electronics store to now in the comprehensive flight system that we've adopted and we're still testing is that we actually have the ability to directly connect to your handset. So we'll talk more about what we've done in Puerto Rico, but the idea that you can take an existing network, an existing carrier, and expand this through sort of the back end of the network and be able to deploy their network to their users in times requires no ground-based antenna to bolt onto your house. It requires no custom receiver. It requires nothing like that. It's your cell phone in your pocket. It's mind-numbing to me to be out in some of our test sites in the desert or here and have your own phone, my own personal device, and have no service, and then thanks to partnerships with our network providers, know that a balloon is coming overhead and have full service. So that's something to think about. Just as all of us are in this conference so heavily reliant on mobile and data, you know it personally. You feel it. It's visceral when you don't have service. And so this is something that we can all kind of take in for our daily lives. So as I said earlier, the idea with Loon and where this concept was born was where are those markets in the world that people are offline. So there's lots of efforts in this space, but the next billion users is a term people are very familiar with. Those users are not necessarily in geographic hubs in densely populated areas. It's a different solution for a different problem, and we've really tried to break that down. And so what we've designed Loon for to this date is the frequencies and the spectrum and the communications systems that we've employed through our radios is designed for rural and remote communities. It's designed for rural users. So where a smaller coverage map of towers works for highly dense areas like the downtown San Juan, what we're trying to enable is the reach for our telco partners to be able to take their network and their footprint without the heavily expansive cost of laying fiber or infrastructure and quickly deploy service to areas with low population density. This is what we were working on for many years now before the hurricane struck, and we were expanding in a very healthy rate. We were, operating at scale per se already, prior to Hurricane Maria here about a year ago or 6 months ago. So if you look at this in a clockwise fashion from the top left, there's a picture of me, and I was sharing this at lunch with some colleagues. But there's a picture of me holding a latex prototype with some of those beer foam coolers stuck together as a proof of concept. That was only 2012. As we've gone through and figured out the things we need to do for super pressure ballooning, for the actual aeronautical parts of this, and then the product evolution of our actual flight system, we were through the rapid prototyping phase in 2015, and we were on to sort of the field operations phase, which is sort of the not exactly the glamorous software or hardware bits, but these balloons, if you think about them in the stratosphere, are the size of a complete tennis court or two tennis courts wide. So they're very, very large balloons with a very large footprint. When they go up, because gas is not expanded yet, they actually look like a jellyfish in that picture on the bottom left. But That's not an easy thing to handle on the ground, and for a variety of reasons, you know, we don't like our skin touching the plastic because we want these things to last in the stratosphere, and so we don't want to introduce chemicals and things like that. So it's like treating it with kid gloves. The joke when we manufacture the balloons is our manufacturing teams actually wear you know, shark slippers or cotton socks and stuff like that, and the softer the socks, the less damage to the balloon. So even in handling the balloon at the launch sites, we've had to develop systems that are able to launch these at scale. We used to take a dozen of us, and we would time it so that when the winds were the calmest at any of our testing sites at 2 or 3 in the morning, and all of us would gather around and try to launch one of these massive balloons because they were a lot bigger than they were the size of the white jellyfish-looking thing in the bottom left. And that was obviously a very cumbersome process and not going to support our rapid deployment. So we went hard to work and built, actually taking a giant boat crane, a gantry crane, and built an automated launch unit. And this launch unit can take the same balloon, and instead of a dozen of us, take a couple operators, and they can launch a dozen balloons in a half an hour, or in a day's time. In fact, one balloon like every 30 minutes. So we've been able to flip that problem, or that part of the problem, on its head. When we're doing that, we need obviously manufacture more because we're building these things. So we're able to grow through a lot of the scaling that we needed to do to make the timing very right for us to be able to help in situations like this. You know, it's not really pictured on here yet. I think I have another slide talking about it. One of the things we were talking about at lunch was the balloons, whatever goes up must come down. And so we land the balloons as a regular part of our product lifecycle. The balloons last 100 days or longer. In fact, we've had balloons, our record breaker, lasting 190 days. The longer we can get the balloon to stay in the stratosphere and stay aloft, the more people we can provide coverage to and the more areas we can cover. And so it becomes a term of economics to figure out how long we can actually make the balloons last, and they're still a hundredth of the cost of a satellite. So we're still winning in that regard, even when we expand the day by 1, 2, 20, and we're working on balloons to last many, many, many hundreds of days longer. So that would be the goal. I got this example to show you and illustrate what it's like to be able to navigate the winds and explain more of that concept of sailing the stratosphere. So we do have a launch site on the eastern side of this island. We've had it here since 2014, I believe, 2015. And we were constantly launching tests, and we were doing a lot of tests with a telco partner we have in Peru. And so learning about how the winds at the equator work, this is one of the reasons we selected Puerto Rico a long time ago. You know, the winds move above the jet stream, not just east to west. They move in a variety of directions, and that's a novel thing that we learned, and it's a great part of extrapolating those winds. So we're able to find those based on the altitudes we pick. And so you can see in this example, it took us 12 days to transit from Puerto Rico to Peruvian airspace over there on the western coast of South America. And many of those days, in fact, about 10 of them, were spent just going north or south from Puerto Rico down towards Brazil, down towards the mouth of the Amazon. And then we're able to just take on that atmospheric ballast and dip down into the faster winds of the stratosphere and take 2 quick days to ride across the entire continent. And then we're able to pop right back up, no pun intended, and be able to stick around the Peruvian airspace for 100 days. So this is quite a standard flight, but this is kind of the ways that we're using sort of our algorithms to extrapolate where the winds are going and what we want to do. The navigator is essentially optimizing for the fastest path there, and it's not always a straight line from A to B. There's other challenges that come with ballooning that we've had to learn and iterate over time, which is a fun part about being a technology project like this. So we've instituted a whole control and monitoring mission control team. And, of course, as with all things Google, we like not to always have so many humans in the loop, but there's parts of our airspace system and the global airspace system that are still heavily reliant on human intervention. And so the safest thing to do is to make sure we build all the redundancies in place. So while we've automated a lot of what the flight planning and mission planning is, where our balloons actually are able to sense where they're going to be in space and time and file those flight plans appropriately and dispatch them to the appropriate air traffic controllers, sector to sector or country and country, You know, we're respecting all these sovereign airspaces. We also have a mission control team that is manning the phone, per se, to be able to communicate in the chance of anomalies, in the chance that balloons are doing something different than what we intended, or also just to be able to communicate our position for other aircraft as we ascend and descend through the airspace. We've had to learn about the predictability of our navigation, and so that is continuously improving every day. I think if I'd given this talk to you 6 months ago or a year ago, I would not have been able to talk about the levels of accuracy. But one of the beautiful things about software-aided simulation is that we fly more miles in simulation a day than we've flown in the 27 million square mile or miles of flight that we've actually flown through the history of the project. So we're able to harness a lot of computing power towards this problem. And then there's other aspects of the program that are very physical in the real world. You know, when a balloon shows up in your farm and we've landed it there as a nice safe place to land, working with air traffic control and the respective agencies, it doesn't look normal and never will look normal. So it's a fun conversation that you, the farmer, and I get to have about what it is and what it's doing. As soon as people in the world realize that it's an access project, the reception of these things change because where we're working and where we're testing and where we've been up until this point experimenting with the project are in those places that need us the most. And so I can attest to you that the reception is quite warm, which is great. And we're constantly learning. I think one of the things you'll take after the later half of this presentation is that Loon is now not so much an experiment, but open for business, which is something that after many, almost half a decade, is funny to say, but we're very ready for that. So again, to recap, before we go into sort of the disaster response aspects of what we've done, you know, we've been able to go from balloons that went up and popped to balloons that last hundreds of plus days on a regular basis on average. And we've been able to travel the world 27 million frequent flyer balloon miles at a time. And we're delivering connectivity on a regular daily basis, working with telco partners in regions to expand their coverage of their networks. And in the case of Puerto Rico, up here until March 1st, was working with AT&T till their network was restored to deliver connectivity right here. If you have an AT&T phone and you were on the island in parts that were unconnected or underconnected, you would have been on Loon and you wouldn't have known it. You would have been seeing your AT&T service just as you normally can expect. So we like to say that, you know, Loon isn't a disaster response product. We'd never intended it, build it that way. However, one of the things we clearly learned following some horrible things that happened in Peru and in Puerto Rico, we learned that we're incredibly resilient to the things that normally occur in, we learned from earlier presentation, on the ground following a disaster, the wipeout of power and telecommunications and such. So, you know, in March a year ago to the month, Peru had seen the worst flooding that it's seen in decades. There was landslides all over the country. These photos were, a few of them were taken by our own team, a few were publicly available, to illustrate the level of how much damage. Entire roads and bridges were just completely swept underwater. The water levels were well above roofs in many, many communities. And this was an area that we had been testing with a telco partner in Peru for a very long time. So we really felt obligated to help, but it was pretty challenging. So we had been there for a while, like I said, and we had a lot of things going for us in Peru that were aiding this effort that we took on. Our balloons were already flying in the area, and we already had some equipment that was on the ground installed, so we were able to pipe into the main network and with a backhaul ground station that was able to, you know, that device is able to beam internet up to the balloons and through signal, and then that the balloon is able to propagate that back down to users via LTE. That interconnect, like I said, was already done with Telefonica in Peru. But just as others had suffered, we had also suffered in terms of what had happened on the ground with the weather. So our team was able to take that situation, do some survey work, quickly get our backhaul sites up, and through a lot of work between between going on locally in Peru and our Mountain View headquarters, get the ground station and backhaul connectivity restored so that the network that was already flying above the Peruvians was able to be just connected again, turned right on. And so we were very successful. And it clued us in to laying the groundwork, the first bricks for realizing that we were able to help when a disaster hit a little closer to home for us. Like I said, we'd had a launch site here in Puerto Rico for a long time. And when Irma and Maria hit in Puerto Rico, our site was genuinely affected, devastated to the same degree. And it was a brutal storm. These are pictures our team took. There's a picture of the red Jeep that you can see was a drive to our launch site. It's not every day that a boat is sitting in the middle of your commute. So they really provided some reality checks for us on what our team was going through on the ground and how bad the situation was to be without power, drinking water, and that connectivity. And we saw this earlier too. So I want to reinstate that a little bit, that message. Mr. Rodriguez mentioned the status.pr, so there's a different illustration of that, not the satellite version, but the screenshot that they were actually providing, and really at this point we were starving for information anytime that you're in a blackout situation. And just south of our site in Humacao, you can actually see some of the ground-based equipment on the ground. These are towers completely knocked over, telephone poles split in half. So again, some of the devastation. So we were on the ground 6 days after the hurricane, after our folks had left their shelters that were here, that stayed on the island, and the folks that evacuated. Like I said, we were back 6 days after the storm had passed. And we had a lot of things going for us. One of the things we had going for us was that we have a prototyping launch site, sort of a test facility in northern Nevada. That site isn't usually used to reach our networking partnerships that are going on around the world because we have the site here in Puerto Rico, so the proximity is always a little closer. However, since our launch site was down, we were able to quickly turn our launch site in Nevada into the production facility to be able to support deploying balloons over the top of Puerto Rico, something we had never really considered before. Because we had people here, they were able to pull our equipment out of the bunkers and storage and quickly re-engage it for a while using satellite backhaul and quickly working with AT&T and T-Mobile and other partners, including the GSMA and the FCC and the Puerto Rican government, to find backhaul access because the undersea lines were not affected. And like I said, within a matter of a couple of weeks, especially doing the interop with our telco partner, we had balloons covering the island, and we had service restored to users, just focusing quickly on the critical communications piece, and then opening it up to like I said, AT&T and T-Mobile to be able to supply coverage for their regular users. So we have a pretty mission-oriented team. They're based in Puerto Rico. They shared some insights for me. I asked them for cool stories, and I remembered these three as ones that stuck out in my mind to try to illustrate the resolve of what our project has been through. We had a team that needed to get telecommunications gear in, and so of course we hitchhiked it onto boxes of water filters that were being sent to San Juan, and we joke about the most expensive water filters and radio equipment that's ever been sent into the field, but the concept of just simply getting radio equipment for our ground station, a replaced part that might be the size of your laptop, into an island that has no working airport, that has no power, that has no communications, that has really nothing going for it, it's incredibly hard. And so finding unique ways to be able to get that back on, I can't imagine if I had that much trouble, a multi-day effort to get a shoebox-sized piece of equipment into Puerto Rico following a hurricane, how much trouble the power companies or the network companies had to get cell towers or other replacement equipment back here. So we're very fortunate that we were in a position to help with that. We were partnering with the military who were working alongside our launch site over there at the Roosevelt Roads, decommissioned air station. And they sort of reactivated that airfield since that runway was unaffected. And so here's a couple pictures. We had to do some trade and barter. We really needed some support from them to be able to get into the airfield and get our power and lights back on so we could start figuring out our ground station restoration. And they needed a crane to be able to help one of their rescue helicopters. Well, we had a crane that launched balloons, so why not attach a helicopter component to it and use it to do such? So our team was pretty resilient in that matter, and all of that shaved time off of our response. And so, like I said, it's a lot of different work that went into creating the network that has 200,000 users, you know, on it at an active basis. And so here's a map of our coverage in Peru at any given day. I think I took this sometime in January after the response on a random day, just to see, to illustrate how that coverage looks like for those of you learning about Loon. You know, the balloons sort of represent a cone, and in that cone there's a confidence to the edge of that green circle. And then, so if you're underneath that, that's where you're going to get LTE, you know, penetration. So I have a short two-minute video that we made to help illustrate some of the efforts we had in Puerto Rico that I thought I'd share before we take questions.
It's down to Puerto Rico to respond.
I think you want to. Sorry.
When I really realized what was going on was the next day I was trying to call my dad. I was trying really hard to communicate with him, and I couldn't. This was me, a government official, and was not being able to communicate with his father.
I didn't expect it was going to be this bad. I knew it was going to be bad, but I wasn't expecting it was going to be this bad. We had internet before Maria. We had so many things, and we depended on the internet for everything.
So we actually have two launch sites, one's in Puerto Rico and one's in Winnemucca. And what happened when Hurricane Maria blew through is it took out a substantial portion of our facilities in Puerto Rico. So we switched to launching out of Winnemucca, and we had to find kind of new ways to navigate the balloons down to Puerto Rico to respond to the emergency. Loon actually wasn't designed for disaster response, but because we already had ground infrastructure in Puerto Rico, we were able to quickly respond. I'm excited that we were able to provide basic connectivity to hundreds of thousands of people after the hurricane. Some of the things that we learned from this experience were that before a disaster strikes, we need to secure spectrum, import all of our equipment, and test the full system so that we can restore connectivity as quickly as possible.
There's got to be a playbook for disaster. Telecommunication has become a necessity. So I'm a firm believer that Loon should be part of that disaster respond playbook for telecommunication.
We're going to get back. We have to get back. We were doing it before, and we can do it again. And the internet is going to do that.
So that's what I had to share, and I'm happy to take questions if folks have them.
Thank you very much. We'll take it in order you're sending.
The goal of Project Loon is to bring internet to the...
I've heard rumor over the years of shortages of helium. Is that an issue for you guys?
So we were actually discussing this at lunch. So we do use helium gas, and we've certainly looked into all types of gas, but the amount of helium that we use compared to the actual global supply is quite negligible in this regard. And things like being able to figure out and optimize how many balloons we need, we're not talking about tens of thousands of balloons in a ring. We're talking about using the winds to cluster a few balloons, like in this case five, to supply a whole island. So it's quite small in that regard. And we're constantly, looking at that situation too. There's all sorts of developments in that space, and we know it's a finite resource.
Tomas Grachenko, Creator Labs.
Can we please identify each other or ourselves before we speak, because the remote audience doesn't know who's speaking.
So repeating, Tomas Grachenko from Creator Labs. I wanted to ask you to please upload your presentation to the website. It's very interesting, but I can't find it, so please do.
Sure. So I think Dr. Lisi had mentioned this in the morning. I apologize, but one of the caveats to us coming here to talk about this is so much of Loon is changing all the time. I could point you to our website, projectloon.com, but the team at HOMA is actually quite sensitive about what they share. They were happy to have me come and share this here, but at the end I can share a link. I'll make sure that goes onto the Adobe Live to be able to point you to our website where we can find more info.
Okay, thank you for that.
This is Robert Martin Lejeune from PCH. So you have one balloon covering a radius of 40 kilometers. So I'm wondering, do you cooperate with all operators, or do you work as a repeater? How does it work? How does power consumption work? Do you have, I suppose you have solar cells, but batteries for the night? And how many users can you actually support? Because one balloon, 200,000 users by five balloons, isn't it a little bit oversaturated with everybody doing weird stuff? And
so, yeah, I'll take those questions one at a time. The first one was regarding sort of square coverage, correct? And so in the model that we have, the radios are attenuated to be able to support reaching direct to the handset, and that's where the footprint changes. That rural sort of focus we have is based on density, as you've sort of caught on to. And so the density problem is something we constantly are able to manipulate based on what is the optimal coverage in region. So taking a population map and figuring out where users are, working with the telco provider. Actually, to go back, I think the very first question you asked was, we dedicate one balloon per network. So in the case where we were working with T-Mobile and AT&T, we might have a balloon supplying through their core network and then another balloon supplying through another telco operator's core network to keep the data separated. So it's not completely shared pipeline because it has to interconnect through the operator who is responsible for sort of the provisioning of your device and your data and all of the flow that goes on behind that. So in essence, there's nothing that says we couldn't put two balloons side by side and one would serve, you know, AT&T customers or one would serve T-Mobile customers. It's really about the penetration piece is something that we have a good sense on with the operator to collaborate with them and find out where their users are and what we need to support. Even in the mobile market, I feel quite confident in that space and being able to understand it. The second one was we do have on the reason that it's not a beer cooler anymore is because we need to take on enough battery and sort of radio optimization technology in the prototype, the flight system that you saw that's not a prototype anymore in the video, but, you know, four solar panels and quite a large piece of equipment, still much smaller than a cell tower or standard ground-based infrastructure, but quite enough to be able to support us providing through the night and harvesting power from the sun during the day. One key advantage being 20 kilometers up is that you're a little bit closer to the sun, so you can get quite a bit more energy than you would from the same size panel and the same grid on the ground. So we're able to harvest in that way. And then, sorry, did you have one more?
No, I was thinking about everybody was relying on only these balloons. I mean, most of the island would have been relying on the balloons. When they're completely saturated with traffic?
Yeah, it becomes, for one, there's multiple ways to think about how that saturation happens. You can have it to, like in connectivity, in disaster, you can have it to a select group of users if you needed it to be for emergency response. In some instances, we talk a lot now, the narrative has shifted about preparedness. I think Dr. Lisi was mentioning that too. And so that's something that we think about that we're making conscious decisions about. But two, it's really about the diameter of the pipe to say where your backhaul is coming from and the latency and speed of that backhaul. So then when we're able to provide that, we sort of know what our saturation numbers are, and then we're able to figure out, do we need two balloons to provide coverage for this area, or three, or 10, or five? So it's sort of an algorithmic problem. You plug these things into this computation and say, oh, okay, based on the density and the type of traffic being consumed, I know how many balloons I need to serve for that many users. It's again, the experience is different than the data-rich experience that you might have in the room right now. It's not, you know, we're using LTE spectrum and LTE radios, but really the user experience is probably a lot less speed than that. You know, you're probably thinking about a 2G, 3G comparison in terms of how traffic is flowing. But it's connectivity. It's the critical messaging. Like, we'll support, you know, over the top messaging services. We'll support email. We'll support things like that.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
So
thank you.
One balloon, maybe like 500,000 users, if you're lucky. What is that? Something you can estimate?
I don't think it's something that you could just estimate in like binary like that. Like, it really depends on you know, how much traffic is flowing and what your backhaul situation is like.
Howard Ben, Samsung Electronics. First of all, I think I'd make a comment about your numbers. At the moment, mobile connects 6.2 billion active users, so I'm not quite sure how many additional users, because you're using the LTE technology, and something like half of those users don't actually use LTE today.
Yeah.
But more importantly is that for 5G at the moment, we are developing something called NTN, non-terrestrial networks. So we're trying to optimize 5G to make sure that when that technology gets into handsets, it will cope with situations like this. So I was wondering why companies like yourselves aren't getting involved in setting those standards, given all the experience you've got with LTE.
Sure. I think we've done a couple of things, and I'm happy to discuss more offline and connect you to those specific people on our team. But I know that we're heavily engaged with the GSMA, with other bodies on setting those standards. But we also are very reliant on some of our partnerships in this space. So the radios and things, working with Nokia, working, you know, our team just came back from Mobile World Congress, and I know that they're heavily involved in that space and what the future is. The beauty of again going back to a system that goes up 100 days at a time is that we're able to refresh the hardware just as fast as to keep up with these changes. So it's not just things like software we're pushing. You know, it's very common that by the time a fleet of balloons might land, that we're pushing hardware changes into their radios, and we've seen that iteration over the years as we've developed new radios. The first iterations of Loon before we pivoted into the LTE space to go to handset were actually with Wi-Fi. That's why it's such a novel switch for us. We originally started with the old Ubiquiti Rocket and tried to shove that in a box, and so we know the space is changing, and I'd like to think that we've that covered, but I'm happy to connect offline and we can pass people that.
I'm Ajay Data for the court. Two, three questions in one go. One, how do you cover under the licenses if there is any license in a particular country to operate for internet services?
Yeah.
Does this require any license, or does this bypass any license, or you can just fly anywhere and provide services? That's one. Secondly, how does
I can take them one at a time if it's easier for you. So one of the funnest things about my career at Loon is that we're at the intersection of many of the world's most heavily regulated industries. I'm just kidding. It's not that fun. But the point being that aviation, telecommunications, and broadcasting and all of these spaces are quite heavily regulated. So we recognize that. We also recognize that we span across them. So on the aviation side, we are beholden to the sovereign airspace controls of every country we fly over. Hence, we don't fly over certain countries. You know, in cases of natural disaster, some of our countries that normally tell us, you know, to go away, we're certainly open to saying, hey, Puerto Rico needs you, and, you know, despite foreign relations, let's make this work right now, which we were incredibly pleased with and proud of, that, you know, people can recognize that in a disaster scenario. But in terms of as a product, as an actual market solution in the enterprise space here, you know, we have our wind algorithms that block off those airspaces and are able to react to the daily change of governments and issues around the world, so that, you know, the balloons don't have to overfly Russia or North Korea or China or those places when those things are not allowed. That's the beauty of being able to navigate. And then on the telecommunications side, switching gears, you know, we secured these licenses with the FCC, an experimental license to transmit. We worked with FEMA as they were using some of the available unlicensed space for short radio links on the ground. So we are able to deconflict a lot of those things, and we do have to get those permissions. A lot of the spectrum that we secure is through our telco partners that we work with because they already own those that spectrum for their users. They're using it on the ground. And so a lot of time we spend engineering-wise is deconflicting how those signals correlate with each other or work atop of each other.
Thank you. Second, do you think, I can understand the case of disaster recovery where the Puerto Rico and Peru faced the situations and you served. Do you think there are very difficult situations and locations where the fiber has not reached, even the wireless has not reached, and even the power has not reached?
Absolutely.
And if you want to serve the places like that, then
absolutely.
Do you think it is viable proposition in terms of the internet cost or anything else?
Yes,
to
yes,
serve them
absolutely.
There right now?
The first place we were going with this before disaster struck was working with these telco partners to illustrate how we can reliably bring continuity of service in places that they expect you demand a high degree of reliability working with your regular market customers in places that they actually don't go. The reason people aren't online, say, in a valley in the mountains is because the cost of laying fiber to get to that limited number of users. So if we can democratize that by making it a little bit cheaper for the telco partner to be able to continue to serve those users sort of on demand with network as a service in this concept, you can go places that you don't have to take towers and power and cable and still be able to go. Those people have handsets. I mean, they still have an LTE device. You know, in Peru, we learned that there's a large variety of our customers that form our telco partner that live high in the Andes and come down to the towns on the coastal range in Peru to work. And they take their device with them in their pocket. And so they are used to, in the third world, having, and developing countries in the second world as well, having the devices and knowing when and where they can't get service. Anybody from a rural community knows the spot you can go to and the weird stance you have to raise with one leg. And I think there was a picture of it on one of my very first slides of finding that tree so that you can get that signal. You know, that's a problem that we think we can solve.
And the last question.
Yes.
I can understand that Balloon will be having two transmitters, two receivers.
Yes.
And it will act as an intersect. So can you connect any of the transponder and receiver and any geography which is in the coverage, obviously?
We're currently, right now, you know, in LTE, they talk about it in phases, and we certainly, you know, we fly one, transmit, one, receive, and we've looked at multiple up to four sectors. And so we're constantly evolving that technology. We're experimenting with all different types. You know, flying multi-sector antennas is something we're very excited about. And again, it points right back to if this was a $100 million satellite or something in the space, one of the things that makes us so competitive, we feel, is that we're able to refresh this hardware and figure that out. And so there's so much iteration going on. So, yes, yeah.
Okay, thank you very much.
No problem.
I've got two comments. A friend of mine from Namibia came to Puerto Rico and to St. Martin, and he works for a company that deals with TV white space. So he told me that regulation is not a problem. This is not a developing country or India or Pakistan or Namibia where the regulator needs to be stroked and sorted out. That what in emergencies, things in America tend to happen very quickly. At least the government officials, not necessarily the politicians. But regulation is not a problem.
Hang on.
And the second thing is, I fully agree, when I go and visit my mother-in-law in the north, in rural north of Namibia, I'm always watching. I can't do YouTube, I can't do this, I can't do this. She doesn't care, she can phone, she can send me a Telegram message, we don't use WhatsApp, that works even with 2G. We're probably a little bit spoiled with the requirements we have. I remember you in UUPC and we didn't even know what an attachment was. Nowadays, 10, 20 megabytes attachments, regular basis, no drama. And we're getting, as you said, it's visceral. If you go somewhere and you don't get 4G and it's not, it's instant gratification. If you don't get it, maybe if we come down a little bit to earth and provide a service that is available to everybody, even if it's not 5G or 7G, if it's just 2G or 3G, you can make your phone call if there's an emergency. Maybe you don't get an ambulance there, but a helicopter usually will find its way. These things work. And as for the rest of the presentation, I can just say, wow.
One of the biggest motivations our team in general had for trying to deploy so quickly in Puerto Rico was that status.pr site. If anybody's navigated the site, or if you could do it right now, like our presenter said that it was up, Mr. Rodriguez, but the site is super plain. It doesn't take a lot to load. It's not fancy. It's primarily text-based, but it told you where the water was. And so for Puerto Ricans suffering from this disaster, they weren't trying to, YouTube or FaceTime, although we support those services, we support data, they were trying to find out where the gas was available or the water was available for their generators or for their home, or which hospitals were open. So I think we feel really strongly about, knowing that some access is good access.
Thank you very much. This Thank was you. One of the best presentations I have ever seen here. Thank you so much for
Thank
coming
you.
And give him a big hand. So we are now going to allow the other people to leave who were polite enough not to open the doors all the time while somebody was speaking. And we meet at 20:25 past 3.